It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, four people, including a five-year-old girl, vanished in Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults and long-hidden secrets.
Yep, we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, The Nan Up 4. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is your home of new fiction. Each week we select books to bring to your attention from Australia and around the world.
And thinking of Australia, Cassie, this week we have two books set in regional Australia. They both have brothers and sisters, lost children, shame, and some really surprising plot parallels.
Mm-hmm. Eva Hornung and M.L. Stedman, the authors of those books, and guests today, Michael Rowbotham and Rowena Gonzalez.
But let's begin with the London Blitz, not quite as you might know it.
Frances Spufford is an English writer and academic who began by writing non-fiction, I May Be Some Time, Ice and the English Imagination. Of course, that's a reference to that doomed Antarctic expedition by Scott and Co.
Yes, and what a great quote that he uses. I mean, I do think Frances Spufford has such a way with words. He also wrote a book called The Boy That Books Built and a number of others, and that was before he found his voice in fiction.
And that was about his love of C.S. Lewis, the author of the Narnia series, amongst others. Beloved, of course, by so many of us, but no one probably more than Frances Spufford, because he then went on. Now, we have to be careful here. He wrote an unauthorised book inspired by the Narnia world.
And apparently it sort of circulated behind the scenes, but it's become like a sort of a lost and imagined book that we can't read, Cassie.
In fact, Claire Nichols on our sister program, The Book Show, asked Frances Spufford this week about that mysterious book, and this is what she got out of him.
Did I read somewhere that you've actually written your own Narnia book?
I did, but got into some legal trouble, so I really shouldn't talk about it on the radio, Claire.
It's on your Wikipedia page. People can go and check it out
I know,
and find out more.
It's not totally a secret, is it? But all the same.
But maybe we can talk about it in 10 years' time when copyright is available on the Narnia books.
I'm hoping so. Of course, C.S. Lewis is out of copyright in New Zealand now, but that doesn't make things quite as simple as you'd think they would be. Anyway, mustn't go on about that.
Oh, isn't that tantalising? Yeah, well, there you go. It's a great interview and you should check it out. It's on the Book Show's program page or on ABC Listen.
But also, what a great way into this writer who is also so actively a reader. And I think you can even see that in his other fiction. I mean, his first novel was from 2016 called Golden Hill, and I really loved that, Cassie.
Yeah, you loved it.
Well, and it's a novel that's set in New York before New York existed. So it's before the War of Independence. I guess it's New Amsterdam. And that began, I think, a series of novels, all of which used different literary conventions, but all of them really interested in cities. He also wrote Light Perpetual, which began with a bomb blast, with the split second of a bomb blast in the 1940s. And then there was Cahokia Jazz.
Ah, now that's the one I loved.
It's so
I still love it. It's set in 1922 in America, on the site of one of the great cities on that continent, which, well, it's now an archaeological site alongside the Mississippi, but he reimagines it. It's an Aztec city, Cahokia, and it's a great what if. What if all those people weren't killed by diseases with contact from Europeans? What if they had remained strong and, in fact, thrived and run cities the way they're run by the descendants of white Europeans now? Wonderful book.
Well, and also, as well as doing a speculative history that's a sort of multiracial story, he uses the scaffolding of noir detective fiction to tell that story. So he's both a sort of imaginative innovator, but he's also somebody who's very aware of different literary traditions and uses them, which brings us, I guess, to his new novel, Nonesuch, another playful book that begins in London in 1939. How about you have a go at setting it up for us?
Oh, gosh. Okay. So we know that is the beginning of World War II, but we know what happened. The people in London in 1939 didn't. It's just the start of the reality of what this war might be like. So the blackouts haven't even started. They're still doubting Winston Churchill and his dire warnings. There's certainly no conception of what is coming, and the Blitz and the bombing and the utter destruction of parts of London. But they have started to build Anderson huts. Now, these are the places in the backyard that people had to build to go down in case there was a bombing raid. But we meet this incredible woman called Iris Hawkins, who's working in a sort of financial company. I can't explain it, but if she was here, she would be able to, because she's a financial whiz, but unfortunately born female in this era. So she's a secretary, but is far more capable than her bosses realise.
And she's a really interesting character to begin the novel with, because as it opens, she's going out for the night. She's gone on a silver dress. She's meeting a guy who she doesn't have a particular stake in. He's a bit of a hooray Henry posh guy who can maybe pay for the drinks and ideally take her out drinking in the Savoy. And he's sort of awful. Things that about their night out get derailed. And it's partly because she is clever. She dares to be outspoken. She has opinions on things like money. And so she ends up going off with another young woman called Eleanor, who's a sculptor, to a club where she meets all these other people. Now, if this was a conventional historical novel, the hero of it would be Eleanor, because Eleanor's an art student. She's a sculptor. She's got the sort of wild hair. And a character like Iris would be the conventional working girl. But instead, he turns things on its head. We see that Eleanor, this sculptor, is part of the privileged class, and Iris's take on things are more interesting. And we see her spikiness because she's really aware of class. She meets all of these people in this club, including this awful aristocratic woman called Lowell. She meets people who work at the BBC, and she sort of argues with everybody.
Mm. Yeah, she's a fresh character, I think. We haven't met someone like her for quite a while. Although, just to Eleanor's defence, she's an artist. She's even got the stone dust under her fingernails that she can't be bothered to scrape out.
I liked her as a character.
But she's not just upper class. She belongs to this bohemian scene, which captures what was going on there. Because this was a frightening time, people knew that. They were living life to the full and going out at night, staying out all night and dancing and still rocking up at work the next morning, maybe even in their silver dress or whatever they'd managed to pull together.
And testing out ideas. I mean, even early ideas of television, of money markets, of the shape of the world. Some people could see that the world was going to change, and others said, no, of course it's not, and of course we will triumph. So we're on this real cusp of something. And so it feels like we're being set up for a particular type of World War II novel.
Yes. And this is well-trodden territory, of course, this era of the Blitz. We know about it from the screen. We know about it from novels. I mean, the brilliant Graham Greene wrote about it on numerous occasions. The End of the Affair, the fantastic one, and Ministry of Fear, real touchstones in the story of the Blitz as a background to the private lives of Londoners. But as you say, this book takes a serious turn off the road and into, would you call it fantasy, Kate?
Yes. And you know, as we heard when he talked about C.S. Lewis, he is familiar with the tropes of fantasy fiction. And I think particularly of urban fantasy and of a stream of fantasy fiction that plays around with London in particular and with ideas of sort of esoteric thinking and spiritualism and all other things that were happening at the very beginning of the 20th century. But the way that it plays out, we said she went off to another nightclub and met these people. She went home to the suburbs with a lovely, with a sweet young man, Jeff.
Yeah, he's very good at maths. In fact, well, it's a bit saucy, but at some point Iris instructs Jeff to recite the prime numbers in sequence just to distract him from something that she would not like to happen so quickly. Listeners, your imagination can fill in the rest.
And so they have this sweet night together, but she wants to leave. She wants to go back home.
Well, she's moving on. I mean, she's a busy girl.
Exactly. And she's very careful of herself and her way in the world. And so she leaves, and there is this figure made of, it appears, you know, an old overcoat and piles of newspaper.
Papier-mâché.
Yeah, this menacing.
Tall, very tall. And its head is leaning, resting on its shoulder. It's quite spooky.
Yes, it's almost like a shadow encased in all of the detritus of the city.
Mm.
And there's something there that's threatening her. And so she has to come back into the house, and then she has to try to work out what's going on and what's this force. And some of the answers come from sweet Jeff's, also sweet, father.
Yeah, Jeff's a bit clueless, but Jeff's dad, Mr. Hale, Cyprian Hale, as we later learn, knows a lot more about London and its secrets than most. I don't think we could go too much further into the mystery and the fabulous journey we go on in this, but there are parts of London which are, well, not alive exactly, but they're not dead either.
Well, and there are forces afoot, but there are also people and organisations who want to use these forces and to use them for political gains. So there is an organisation called The Order that really has fascist overtones. And that is where Iris finds herself in conflict with the last traces of this order. And it's very much embedded in the city, in the structure of the place.
Mm-hmm. So the war really begins to take pace, and the city is under bombardment. Meanwhile, Iris, while sort of handling this other world that's existing at the same time, is also applying her mind to the economic opportunities that might arise out of the situation of war, which was another tangent or another element to this book that I really liked.
I thought it was so well done, because it's about money, often explained in ways that are, well, that, like you, that I couldn't do justice to, but that show the complexities of money and money markets in an international setting and in this sort of changing world of the war. And then on a personal level, she's interested in money and power and money and ambition and what it is that thinking about and understanding money can do. But of course, again and again, she's underestimated because she is a young woman trying to enter this world of the economy.
Mm. So this is an exciting story. I did want to get back to it when I had to put it down. It's also one of a pair. There's another book, we think, that might be coming soon.
Yes, and it ends with both a resolution and a cliffhanger. And this is after things that happen both inside and above the city. I mean, it's almost a sense of rooftops and rooftop chases and action and possibilities and things that might mean that we could almost have a reworking of the same novel again from a different perspective.
Well, hopefully he retains that beautiful detail and tapestry of the people's lives, which are touched by fear and loss and genuine dread of what might happen. And in this way, you know, it's a great, well, I think it's very timely. I felt the resonances of what's happening in the broader world around me in this book. And I wonder whether he had that in mind. He may well be as far-sighted as he appears to be in this book. Here's a little of what he said about that, and in particular London, when he was talking to Claire Nichols.
I wanted that era of the city when technology is still a bit magical and when darkness falls because of the blackout and the battle of good and evil is going strong, because 1940 really is London's heroic moment. Although, as we know, the history of the British Empire is, to use a technical term, a bit shit in lots of ways. Actually, when it came to it wobbling in onto the side of the angels, we fought fascism. So that is London's heroic moment. And it seems to me that the kind of the Tolkienian fantasy battle of good and evil actually belongs naturally in that bit of history, with real people and the usual murky mixture of motives, but still it's fantasy adjacent anyway. So somewhere in there my instincts went, do it now. And I have.
And when he talks about angels of our better nature, he may not be speaking metaphorically, Kate.
And when he talks about that battle between good and evil, I think what he does that's interesting, because there's all those sort of grand fantasy, heroic tropes of that, is that he brings it into the lived experience of people in a city under bombardment and the sheer exhaustion of that happening night after night after night. And again, he uses the numbers and he counts it. It's been 48 days, 49 days, 50 days when people wake up and the building next door has disappeared and has been sheared open to the world. And there is something very affecting about reading that story right now.
Yes, tragically relevant. But also, this is a delightful escape with its fantasy elements.
This one really hit me hard and very entertaining, and that's Francis Spufford's Nonesuch. I will always keep reading this man, yeah, I'll confess.
Me too. Yeah, it sounds like a thumbs up from both of us. Now, Kate, this week I was unavoidably called away, and so I wasn't able to be here for the conversation with Michael Rowbotham and Rowena Gonzalez about the two books we asked them to read for us, which were The Minstrels by Eva Hornung and A Far-Flung Life by M.L. Stedman. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing the conversation you had with them.
Because there are some things that are really quite surprising about it, and some of the parallels that happened between these two novels that we didn't even mean to put together. It's just that they happened to be published at the same time. And the things that come out in this discussion, well, Cassie, it's really quite extraordinary.
Okay, let's hear it.
Time now on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf to meet this week's guests. I'm Kate Evans, and as you just heard, Cassie McCullough had to head out of the studio for a while. But with you now to talk books is crime writer Michael Rowbotham and writer Rowena Gonsalves. Hello to both of you.
Hi, Kate.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, before we talk about the books that we've lined up for you today, I wonder if we could talk about libraries. And I've been thinking about them a lot because this year marks the 200th anniversary of the State Library of New South Wales. And the interesting thing I found about, I was reading about the history of this library, is that it began as a sort of private gentleman's club, like a private lending library for men only. And then as the century went on, it really changed and it became tied up with the whole story of self-improvement, of education for the workers. But something I hadn't known was that part of sort of establishing the credibility of the library, the seriousness of the library, was that they started to get rid of the fiction, because fiction was seen as something that sort of undermined the idea of what a library
outrageous.
Was. Absolutely outrageous.
Greatest truths are found through fiction. Yeah. I think that's a real shame to hear that.
I mean, it's a sort of interesting thing about what it is that, that fiction was imagined to do, that it was something that was like a diversion, whereas all the other worthy learning happened elsewhere. I mean, this obviously didn't stick with the notion of the library.
Sounds just like a sort of decision that men would make.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that it didn't stick, because how could it stick? Because if you look at all of the Indigenous traditions and the way knowledge is passed down in First Nations cultures across the world, and we know from our experience here, from listening to First Nations writers and scholars, that it is through stories, it is through fiction that one improves oneself and one learns about one's culture and one learns about how to live a life. And so it has to be fiction, really, that is legitimized and valued. And I'm so glad that that didn't stick.
And so a book's just been published called The Library That Made Me, which includes both a history of the State Library of New South Wales, but then 60 writers have also written personal stories about the library that shaped them. And this is where I have to confess, I've written one of those stories. Rowena, you have as well. And I'm really keen to hear about the libraries that have shaped you. But Michael Robotham, everybody listening to this can also add their own stories. So where would you start? What's a library that's really shaped you?
Well, libraries shaped my entire life. I grew up in very small country towns and where there were no bookshops. And ultimately, it was the library that was the place you went to get anything you needed to read. And I still, to this day, people often ask me, is there a favourite book in your collection? And there is a battered copy of Lord of the Rings held together by gaffer tape that I borrowed so often from my library that I was forbidden to ever take it again, because someone else had to be given the chance to borrow Lord of the Rings. So I took to hiding it in the library so where nobody would find it, and sneaking in to read it. And the librarian, when she discovered my sin, I thought I was going to be punished, but she actually gave me the book. And so I still have it. I feel as though it's the first book I ever earned.
Can you tell us what that library was? Where was it?
That was in Coffs Harbour. But my first library was in Gundagai, but that was in Coffs Harbour, where I spent, you know, I think I was about 12 at the time.
Oh, what a lovely story. Rowena, what were your childhood libraries?
Well, I, as I wrote in the piece in The Library That Made Me, gorgeous book that has been produced by Pip McGuinness in the State Library, the long arm of the library made a writer of me. You know, libraries across the world, the composite of so many different libraries. But my mum worked at Glaxo Laboratories in Mumbai for many, many years. And they had what we think was called the Glaxo Workers Sports Library. It was kind of a collection of books that I think someone had kind of put together, because they were all foreign books, as we call them then. And so mum would bring all these books, would kind of borrow them out of the Glaxo Workers Sports Library and bring them home to us. And that's how I guess developed a love of libraries, or looking forward to the next set of books that mom would bring over. And then I tried to start a library of my own, except it didn't work because I didn't know what I was doing.
as a child
in Mumbai, yes. But yes, I absolutely, as a writer, have been shaped by many, many different libraries. I mean, in India, we have the University of Nalanda University. They had a library in 427 CE, over 1,000 years before the Bodleian in Oxford. So, you know, there's that whole culture and tradition in India of sharing knowledge through private and public collections of texts. And so being kind of part of that whole, tradition, but also the more deeply personal connection to these little libraries that were that existed in Mumbai is what shaped me.
Well, all of these books, libraries, references, we will, of course, list them on the bookshelf page. Just search ABC Radio National, The Bookshelf, and I'll put a link there to this Library That Made Me project, and anybody listening can add their story to that as well. But look, why don't we turn to the books that we've read together, two new Australian novels, Eva Hornung's The Minstrels and M.L. Stedman's A Far-Flung Life. Now, there's all sorts of reasons why this is going to become an all-in conversation here on The Bookshelf, but let's begin with Eva Hornung's book, which you and I have read, Michael Robotham. And we should say that Eva Hornung is a poet, a critic and a novelist who's also published under the name Eva Salas. Her books include Hyam, Dog Boy and The Last Garden. Now, her latest is called The Minstrels. And Michael, while there's a lot to say about her writing, what I want to begin with is a sense of people, plot and place. So we meet a pair of kids, Jem and Will. What version of Australia are we in?
We're in rural Australia. We are in a small farm in the outback, probably in South Australia, although it's not made clear, mainly because that's where Eva Hornung has spent quite a bit of a life. And these two, brother and sister, Jem and Will, are inseparable. We watch them grow up. We watch them come of age. They're very close as brother and sister, although you always get a feeling that Jem is a bit of a cuckoo in the nest, that Will is the golden child. He's the one that the parents dote on. He's the one that will get the farm when the time comes. And Jem, even though she's very, very clever, much more hardworking, understands the farm far more than Will does, she's always just considered to be slightly an outsider, and she senses it.
And one of the things I found really interesting as I entered this novel is I wasn't entirely sure when in time we were, because we meet these two kids and they're sort of dressed up in their Saturday clothes, you know, going into town, and that sense of sort of heat and boredom and them elbowing each other, and they're very, very uptight parents, particularly the mother, Joylene. There's Joylene and Arthur. And we learn that Joylene absolutely, as you say, adores the sun and is sort of wary of Jem. Like, she was one of these kids, one of these babies who arched her back and squirmed and was never quite comfortable. Whereas her brother absolutely adores her. And he says at one point he loves his sister Jem because she steals lollies from the All Goods shop and gives them to me. Oh, and miss, she gives dead birds funerals. There's something about this portrait of these kids that jumps off the page. But at first I was thinking, is this the 1940s? Is this the 1950s? When are we?
Oh, look, it may be because I think Eva Hornung and I are of similar age. You know, we're in our 60s. I think I might be a few years older. But I pictured it as being back in that sort of era because it just reminded me so much of my childhood. I grew up in very small country towns. I went off to, was made to dress up in my Sunday best and go off to Mass every Saturday evening or Sunday morning. And I recognised so many people in the town. I recognised the way the farmers spoke to each other. I recognised the casual racism associated with the way that they talked about Indigenous people as being, they used the word hopeless. You know, so much of it reminded me of my childhood. So I put it in that sort of era.
And as the book goes on, we get more and more clues. And so we're more located in time. So I think I was only untethered at the very beginning. But what I was tethered to was this really strong sense of place and of farming and of landscape. And there's one particular place, one particular site in the landscape that looms very large. And it's a place called the Minstrels. How did you imagine the Minstrels and what that was?
I think, I mean, because Eva Hornung is a beautiful writer, and it's this sort of, I guess in quite an arid landscape, it is a gorge. It is a gorge with a river running through it and with deep pools, deep, very cold water. And it almost feels as though it's a prehistoric place. It's a spiritual place. it has great meaning, I think, for everyone that goes there. Obviously, great meaning for the Indigenous people, you know, whose land it is. And but quite a mystical, and as it turned out, I felt a sinister place.
Yes, things happen there. And there's a whole lot of things to talk about, the landscape and the language and the way that she evokes it, that we might get to a bit later, Michael. Because if we could just talk a little bit more about the plot. So we've got Jem and Will, this brother and sister. Jem has the skills to work the land, doesn't she? She can drive a tractor. She understands the technical side of things, but she's sort of sidelined. There's a dangerous, there's a sort of uneasy relationship between these two teenagers as they get older. And then something happens, everything changes, and it becomes a story of secrets and change and family and complications. What tragedy. Else would you say?
I think it's interesting watching these children that are inseparable, and as they reach adolescence, that relationship changes. There's a real tension between them, and it's gender-based in a sense. And this particular area, region, they have something known as the harvest run, a ritual after the harvest dance every year. You know, the teenagers or that have come of age do this sort of dramatic run, and there's real sexual connotations to this run. They're masked so you don't know who's chasing after you and who's catching you. But ultimately, this leads to a shocking, shocking conclusion. And what happens on that night will fundamentally change the lives of Jem and Will and their parents and everyone around them. And the book goes from being a coming-of-age tale to being a book driven by a tragedy and how this family is going to cope with it.
And there's so much more to it. But how about we hold that thought, Michael, with a reminder too that this is ABC Radio National's weekly review program and podcast, The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans here with writers Michael Robotham and Rowena Gonsalves. And we've been talking about Eva Hornung's novel, The Minstrels, Regional Australia, A Brother and Sister, A Girl Underestimated, An Accident, Secrets and Shame and Family. And so with all of that in mind, Rowena Gonsalves, you and I have both also read M.L. Stedman's A Far-Flung Life. Now, Stedman is an Australian writer, originally from Western Australia, although she now lives in London. Her 2018 novel, The Light Between Oceans, was an international bestseller. And that one began in 1926, where a couple who are lighthouse keepers on an island off Western Australia, they find a boat containing a dead man and a baby, a living baby, and they decide to keep the baby. So an orphan child and a mysterious past. That's something of an interest to this writer, I think we could say. So, Rowena, given our conversation about Eva Hornung's novel, how would you describe the plot of this new novel we're turning to now, M.L. Stedman's A Far-Flung Life?
When you and Michael were talking about the key themes and the key plot points that are in Eva Hornung's book, it was almost as if you were talking about A Far-Flung Life, except that the discussion about the complexities of the story are different. So in A Far-Flung Life, we are, again, in a rural setting, in rural Australia, but this time in Western Australia, on a massive
pastoral station.
Someone in the book says it's a farm and then gets corrected and says, someone corrects them and says it's not a farm, it's called something else anyway. Oh, they're on sheep. It's a sheep station.
Sheep station.
Right at the start, there's this picture of white perfection, I would say. White perfection in terms of the way the land is possessed. There's the father and the mother and the three children who are all kind of exceptional in some way, except for Rose, who is one of the main characters in this book, who seems, I love the way Rose was portrayed actually, Rose seems like a person who, for whom the boundary between real life and the imagination is quite blurred. And that has some consequences that that are revealed later on in the book. But there's the sense of, you know, everything's going perfectly at the start. The rate for wool is really high, and this family are kind of exceptional. The McBrides are exceptional in this massive part of Western Australia. And then something happens. There's an accident quite early on in the book, and then there's a flow-on effect with family secrets, deep, shameful secrets, and that is the pivot on which the book turns.
And in this one, it's 1958.
It's 1958, yeah, the 50s, the 60s, and then it goes on. I don't want to spoil it, but yeah.
Well, except that what we can say is that, and this happens in the very first couple of pages of the book, is that the father and an older brother are killed in a car accident. Matt, another brother, is badly injured and has neurological damage. It affects his memory. At first, he is also in a wheelchair, like the boy in the other novel. And the relationship between the brother and sister is pivotal to the story. And again, a sister who is skillful, underestimated, trapped in this place with all of the judgment that goes on. And it then also becomes a story about shameful secrets and the tensions between shameful secrets in regional Australia. I promise I did not plan this, that these two books would be read at the same time, but the parallels, as well as the differences, but the parallels are sort of uncanny.
Yeah, absolutely uncanny. But I think from the description of, I haven't read Eva Hornung's The Minstrels, but from your conversation, it just feels like they're quite different books. The focus is quite different in both the books, I feel, even though some of the plot points.
They've certainly become very different, I think.
They do. But even from the beginning, one of the big differences is the way that the landscape is imagined and whose stories are embedded into the landscape. Because we're talking about the history of regional Western Australia and these pastoral stations, I kept on reading it, waiting to see when the dispossession of Aboriginal people, when these other storied landscapes were going to be somehow referenced. And it literally happens at page 100 in three sentences, and 150 pages later in another two or three sentences. And that was sort of shocking.
Yeah, it was shocking to me too. I felt, as I was reading at the start, I felt, you know, I'm in the hands of this wonderful storyteller, but I felt like it's almost too perfect to be true. Surely something's going to happen to kind of cut that sense of, you know, almost erasure of Indigenous prior custodianship of the land. But even with the white family on the land, the McBrides, there's this sense of, it's almost perfect, the relationship between mining and the pastoralists there, the way the novel unfolds. Yes, there are complications, but the main story is not so much about the dispossession of land, but it's really about the family's shameful secrets.
Yes, but you mentioned mining, and the whole story of what happened underneath is part of this. And Michael Robotham, in The Minstrels, there's also a story that emerges about what's underneath the land, but this time it's fracking.
Yes, because ultimately, you know, when the story moves around a little bit, because it does, it's an all-of-life story, basically. We're getting Jem's entire life. And what we've described in terms of that terrible accident is just the first third of the book, really. And we then follow her off to university and ultimately back to the farm. And where she fights the battle to save the farm from the fracking and mining, and she does get control of something that she thought her brother would get control of. But it's interesting talking about the treatment of Indigenous people, because I think that's something Eva does beautifully in the book. You know, having grown up, I remember I grew up in Gundagai, has been mentioned, you know, and there's a very famous story of two Indigenous locals who rescued, you know, dozens and dozens of people during the great Gundagai flood. And when I was growing up in Gundagai, I didn't know that story. It was never mentioned. It was, the flood itself was a huge historical event in Australian history, but it was never mentioned. And of course, you go back to Gundagai now and there's a statue in the main street.
And Anita Heiss has written her novel.
Anita Heiss has written a wonderful book about the flood and about the role they played. But it's just interesting the differences. You know, I lived there in the late 60s, where there's no mention. And that, you know, much, much later, 30, 40 years later, suddenly the town has embraced that story completely. And I think Eva does show that in The Minstrels, how that changed.
There's something else. I mean, she does include an awareness of Aboriginal people and stories and language throughout this whole novel. But she uses language itself to encapsulate the land and the landscape from the very beginning of The Minstrels in ways that I found really interesting. She's using fictional places, and the way that she spells these place names, they often don't have vowels. And it's really interesting. So there's a place that we might think is called something like Dun River, mm-hmm. but it's spelled Dunrver. And it's explained. It says, vowels slipped and fell, consonants eroded, words shriveled in Dun River. Consonants held them together, but the vowels dried up and disappeared. Minstrels were really pronounced minstrels. Diphthongs were clipped. Even the word land was too generous and made a person sound like a city wanker. Unless you were reading from a book out loud, Lund was the Dun River way. Uplands, dunlands, croplands, interlands, whitlands, drylands, whizlands, and the hinterland. And I thought that was so clever.
Yeah, she has an enormous love for protecting it, as it's shown in the novel. And, you know, a big section of the novel is taken up with when she is running the farm and she approaches a local Indigenous elder and becomes, you know, they're more than friends in the end, from a rocky start, because she wants to learn the local language. She wants to learn about the landscape through his eyes, to be able to name every plant, every rock, every tree. And not only does she want to learn it, but she wants to preserve it, because I think there are only about 6 speakers of that language that still exist. And Jem becomes determined to actually create something that will last beyond her and will save that language for future generations.
I wonder what the other, points of connection and difference we should talk about with these two novels that have shame and growing up and stories and drama. So we've got time in this novel, and we also do have a sort of coming of age. I mean, you said, Rowanna, this, that you think the M.L. Stedman is a story about family drama, interpersonal drama.
Yeah. There's a lovely paragraph about an alternative reading of the land. So there's this cartographer somewhere in the middle of the book, page 243, really. A cartographer is inspecting this pastoral kind of a million acres and kind of mapping the land. But the narrator talks about this alternative way of mapping the land, which is about the feel of the fine soil, the tang of the salt brush in the wind, etc. But I think those are kind of exceptions in this massive novel about it's really about family shame and secrets. But just to your point about time, absolutely. I feel like it is about the consequences of time passing on human relationships and on judgmental, kind of the judgmental aspects of ourselves when we're younger, and as we grow older, that kind of falls away and we're more open to other ways of accepting or not accepting others into our lives. I don't want to give anything away from this kind of, the ending I thought was really quite moving. I did shed a few tears myself.
I did shed a few tears myself.
Well, it's interesting. I don't want to give readers the misapprehension about The Minstrels, that it's just a coming-of-age story. Mm. I actually think it is probably 3 novels in one, and that would be probably my only slightly problematic element of the novel, because, you know, it's a coming-of-age story for a third of the book, and then the next third is a recovery from grief or trying to overcome horrendous sort of grief and how you can survive that. And the last third is a post-apocalyptic story along the lines of Stations 11 or The Road, it becomes something completely, and so it's an all of life story. So it covers a vast period of time. But the coming of age element is just the first third of the book, and it has these other novels that are in it as well, which are fascinating and, as I say, beautifully written, but I'm just not quite sure they hang together.
Well, because when I picked up this book, I can never help myself. I do always read the blurb on the back.
Yeah.
I know people make an argument for why you shouldn't do it, but I actually thought the blurb on the back didn't match what I was reading. I was a bit confused because it says that this is a novel that is an apocalyptic redemption fable. And I start reading this historical novel about a family and a childhood and a place. And I thought, hang on, really? How's this a post-apocalyptic redemption novel? And which is sort of what it becomes. And then I really wrestled with myself. Well, what does it mean to have such a long backstory to what becomes an apocalyptic future story? Like, do we need that? Are we not used to reading it?
It's almost the last 80 pages that, and it's one of those issues as well. And again, the choices made, there are no chapters in the book. It is just, you know, there are obviously the little sort of ellipses or whatever that sort of mark a break in scene. But everything morphs. I mean, years and years passed. I mean, decades pass over the course of the book, but there's nothing to sort of break. And even when the apocalypse happens, there's simply, I think, a single line that sort of refers to the third pandemic. And you suddenly think, hold on.
Did I miss the first two?
When were the first two?
Well, and decades and decades and decades pass in M.L. Stedman's A Far-Flung Life as well. And I guess I had a different set of problems with that one, which is that at times it became extremely melodramatic. And there's one point when I had to put it down because I thought, this is unbearable. I cannot. I think I can see what's going to happen, and I'm not sure how I'm going to cope with it. And that was to do with a whole subplot that I thought the book could have lived without, which was with this overzealous cop and this sort of cartoony villain who works in a post office. And I thought, I'm not sure that I needed her. And it was very melodramatic.
Yeah. I was wondering about that post office, the postmaster's wife, who has her own backstory. It was really interesting, but then it kind of petered out towards the end. I just loved that sense of two people becoming more accepting of each other. And it made me think about the questions that the book raised for me were mainly, how do we learn to accept each other while withholding parts of ourselves? And so there's this sense of a deferred understanding throughout the book. There are these things that happen. And as readers, we're not told everything about the key events of the book until much later. We find out much later, and then it kind of, you have to piece together what happened, you know, a few chapters prior. But yes, I agree with what you were saying, Kate. It was just kind of, I kept waiting for this. I think she's a wonderful storyteller, and I kept waiting for this kind of, you know, complexity about land and dispossession or something else to happen with the subplots, etc. But I did shed a few tears, as I said, despite all the things that I'm saying about the book.
Yeah,
it's just pretty moving. Yeah.
It is a satisfying big story that is going to really find, I suspect, quite a big readership. And that is M.L. Stedman's A Far-Flung Life. What about Eva Hornung's The Minstrels? What do you think are the strengths? What do you think are the things that sort of hold you back from
The strengths are definitely, she's such a beautiful writer. She's got such a wonderful way of describing landscape. And I think, as I said, the first third, I could have happily stayed with Will and Jem and that, you know, terrible, tragic night and how they put their lives together after that night. I could have stayed with them completely the entire book. And then it took me a while to get into that next part of the story. And then the last third, the post-apocalyptic section, you know, again, beautifully written. But I'm just sort of, you know, I think it it wasn't long enough section for me to really buy into it, if you know what I mean. But even there's a wonderful sentence where she did a paragraph where she writes, it really doesn't matter which way a world ends or a known world ends or that becomes this, a poison blast, a disease, an asteroid, an end that produces no heroes and no saving. It doesn't matter at all which way this story goes. This story is only her, only now, only one lifetime. And that is Jem. It's the story about her life. And I think, it could win every award going. It is so beautifully written. But I wanted more of each part, if you know what I mean.
I do. But it was unexpectedly useful to read these novels side by side. And that is Eva Hornung's The Minstrels, which is published by Text, and M.L. Stedman's A Far-Flung Life, published by Penguin. Thank you so much for the readings of those two eerily similar books here on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. But we also love a reading recommendation. Rowena Gonsalves, what have you been reading? What do you want to tell us about?
I'm looking forward to Michelle de Kretzer's The Hamilton Case, award-winning book that subverts the detective fiction genre. It's being reissued as a text classic very soon, so I'm looking forward to rereading that. I'm also looking forward to reading Rashida Murphy's Old Ghosts and Carly Olson's Bloodwood, which are novelettes that are being published together in the same kind of book by Night Parrot Press. It's an unusual way of, I guess, publishing works by two authors. So it's, I guess you could call it an anthology of two novelettes, but really looking forward to that. But I've just read Universality by Natasha Brown. And oh my God, I haven't had such fun and such pleasure in reading since I think Michelle de Kretzer's Theory and Practice. But it's just such an exceptionally delicious satire of life in the UK and globally with connections to Australia. You know, you can see the resonances there. But I would highly recommend Universality if you haven't read it. One of the most pleasurable reading experiences I've had for a very long time.
Okay, Michael Robotham, are you going to add to the fun factor? What have you been reading?
Yeah, I'm a bit late to the Charlotte McConaughey party with Wild Dark Shore. And I know it probably doesn't need a plug because it was a New York Times bestseller and a Reese Witherspoon pick. But I'm about two-thirds of the way through that and absolutely loving it. It's the story of Dominic Salt and his three children who are caretakers of Shearwater, a tiny island towards Antarctica, which is the home of the world's largest seed bank, and sea levels are rising and a woman mysteriously washes ashore alive, barely alive. And she has a secret and she discovers the family has secrets. And it's an enormously enjoyable read. It really is. As I said, I'm hoping the first two thirds have been wonderful. I'm hoping it doesn't disappoint on the way home. And my other read is I'm a huge fan of Don Winslow. As a wonderful American crime writer, best known for The Power of the Dog, but many of his books have been turned into films, including Savages and The Life and Death of Bobby Z and whatever. But he retired about 3 years ago to devote his life to political activism against the Trump presidency. And I thought there'd be no more of Don Winslow's writing. And lo and behold, he has produced a short story collection called The Final Score, which features six little short, they're not novellas, they're short stories, but they feature some of his most beloved characters from his earlier novels. And they're always sort of gangsters or private detectives or surfers turned private detectives or whatever. It's, look, anything from Don Winslow. He's a wonderful writer, but it's great to have him back.
Well, and he was a private detective, I think. I interviewed him once.
Yes, he was. That's one of his many careers. He'd done everything from being a wildlife guide in Africa to being a private detective to being an insurance assessor. And actually, all of his novels have featured invariably characters that he may well have a bit of himself in each of them because he's done all those jobs.
Well, as always, we will list all of these books on the bookshelf so you don't have to be running around with a piece of paper and trying to write something on the back of an envelope. Rowena, Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the bookshelf today.
Thanks for having me.
A pleasure, Kate.
Michael Rowbotham is an internationally acclaimed crime writer whose books include the Joe O'Loughlin series, the Cyrus Haven Evie Cormack series, and his latest featuring Philomena McCarthy, The White Crow. His first Australian-based novel is out later this year. And Joanna Gonsalves is a writer whose collection of short stories is The Permanent Resident and whose first novel, called
The Servants,
will be published later this year. She is also one of the hosts of a monthly book club at the State Library of New South Wales.
Okay, well, that is extraordinary. The similarities in the plot of those two books, well, you wouldn't read about it.
And yet we did, Cassie, and yet we did. Now, look, next week on The Bookshelf, we're going to have a conversation about historical fiction with the two writers, Jock Sarong, whose novel takes us to Melbourne in the early 20th century, and Emily Maguire, who travels to 9th century Germany. And so we're just going to talk about what happens when you put these ideas and stories next to each other.
So two Australian authors with historical fiction next week on The Bookshelf.
I'm Kate Evans.
I'm Cassie McCullough. See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.